more than welcome. I actually thought about leaving myself when everybody called and said there was no music, but God's got a way of bringing it. Well, we're going to be in chapter 11 tonight of Revelation, and as we kind of go through this chapter, it's kind of a cool chapter because there's, I love arguing. I love debating. I love seeing guys with different points of view and kind of getting in a room and hashing it out, and I'm okay if there's a little bloodshed and all that, but I love debating. I love kind of going, and this has always been kind of one of those particular chapters that lends itself a lot to who these two witnesses are. So we're going to talk about the two witnesses tonight, and then, you know, it's kind of crazy. As we're going through here, I think as you guys see as we go through the chapter, it's going to matter very little who they are. It's not going to make a whole lot of difference, the two guys that are standing there. I think what we're going to really see and what I hope that we kind of take away from this is that there's two guys empowered by God, given the opportunity to stand before the people in humbleness, to pray for them, to try to get them to convince them to come to God. And as they continue to do that testimony, these guys end up losing their lives for it. And as they lose their lives, it's what the Lord had for them. And as they finish the testimony, as they finish the work that God had for them out, God raises them from the dead. And it says that all kinds of, basically, the people were just super ticked at these two guys. And after these guys leave, they throw parties and do all kinds of stuff. And at the end, it says that when they were raised from the dead and when they rose to heaven, many began to praise the God of heaven. And I as I was kind of going through there, you know, I want to argue, I want to debate, I want to go through all the pieces, but I think what I really want to leave you guys with at the end of all this is that we have a testimony, and we got a job to do, and we've been empowered by God, and we have things that we need to do that He lays out. So we're going to get into that, and hopefully break it all down. So pick up your Bibles, chapter 11, the two witnesses. It says, "Then I was giving a measuring rod like a staff, and I was told, 'Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar of and those who worship there. But do not measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out, for it is given over to the nations, and they will trample the holy city for 42 months. And I will grant authority to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth.'" So as we kind of start out on this whole journey, these first couple of verses is really what's going to lay the foundation for the whole way we look at the rest of it, and the whole way that we kind of see what's going on in here. There's a whole lot of numbers. Anytime there's numbers in the Bible, man, grab a hold of those and take a look at what it's saying. Does anybody know how many 42 months is? How many? 3.5 years. How about 1,260 days? That's also 3.5 years, right? So we're going to kind of go through, and it's interesting, both times as we kind of go through this, when it's talking about the world trampling the holy city, it's going to be 42 months. When it talks about these two guys prophesying, it's 1,260 days. I don't know why God distinguishes the two, but it's the same amount of time. So as we see this, we're going to kind of lay this all out. So the first thing we want to take a look at is, "I was given a measuring rod like a staff, and I was told, 'Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship there, but do not measure the court outside the temple.'" So anytime we see in the Bible, there's quite a few times, I mean, I can think of Ezekiel, I can think of there were several different times that God says, "Here, take this and measure the courts. Measure the things that are going on." We see Ezekiel do it. We see John doing it here. Ezra, I believe, does it. Zerubbabel, I'm not sure. I can't remember now. But all these guys are measuring the court. And what God is doing, as He says measure, is He's going to draw a line between people who believe and are with Him and people that are not. And ultimately, as we come and we start to testify or give our testimonies or we begin to witness for God, we have to realize there's a line in the sand somewhere that differs the people from the inside from then the people from the outside. Right? As we kind of look, He says, "Measure the temple of God, the altar, and all those who worship there." You know, this as he's kind of laying those things out, he's saying, look, these are my people, and I don't want you to measure the outside because it's given to the nations, given to the Gentiles, however you want to call it. But he's given to the nations to trample for 42 months. Now, this takes place in the sixth trumpet. So as we're kind of going through the sixth trumpet, I want you to realize that this whole span of time takes place the whole 7 years. So essentially, this trumpet is blowing for a long time. So as we look at it, how long did it say the nations were going to trample the holy city? 42 months, 3.5 years. Then there's going to, something's going to happen. These guys are going to die. And then it's going to be given, the city's essentially going to be given to the Antichrist. But for 3.5 years, they're going to be doing this. How long is the tribulation total? Right, 7 years, right? We're in the the 70th week of Daniel. It's a 7-year period. So we have these guys coming out, and they're going to trample the holy city. Now, a lot of times when we start reading and start going through this, sometimes we get a little bit lost or a little bit confused about the metaphors and things that are going on, the things that they're using. There's a whole lot of different places in the Bible where it talks about the temple of God. When Jesus comes in and he makes the court of whips, right? And he goes into the temple. That's Herod's temple. That's a temple that Herod built. What does Jesus call it? He says, my house is to be a house of what? My house is supposed to be a house of prayer. So he's calling the temple that Herod built, that's his house. And he drives those guys out. In Ezekiel, they're looking at the millennial temple in that particular one. And that one's called the temple of God. In the Old Testament, there's a city, Shiloh, and they build a tabernacle there, and that's called the tabernacle of God. And so we have all of these places and all of these things and all these cities, all these things that we end up talking about. And I think the one thing that I think we tend to miss is what makes a city of God. Does it have a real pointy roof on the top? Was it, tell me, what makes a city of God? People make the city of God, right? We're going to see as we kind of go through here that the concept of what he's saying, that the enemy, the nations are going to trample the holy city, is going to be for 42 months. That time, that doesn't mean that they stop trampling the city, right? Because as soon as these guys essentially get their marching orders in Matthew 24, who continues to rule and reign over the city? The Antichrist. So we're going to talk a little bit about the city and realize that the city is not always the people, or is not always just the city. It's a lot of time it's the people and the things that are there. So for 3.5 years, from the start of the tribulation, there are men and women worshiping on the temple of God, worshiping God for the entire 3.5 years. And then something happens. These guys end up dying. If you flip over to Matthew 24:15, we can kind of see what happens, right? We probably know the story. Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he says, when the day comes that Daniel, the prophet, spoke about, he said, when the abomination of desolation happens, when the Antichrist comes in and says he's God and sits on the throne of God, what are the people supposed to do? Supposed to leave, right? He says, if you're working on the roof, what are you supposed to do? Supposed to bail out. If you're out mending fence or working in the field, what are you supposed to do? Supposed to bail. Don't even go home and get your jacket. It says, woe to the pregnant woman, woe to those who are nursing, and pray that it doesn't happen in winter, right? So all the nation of Israel is going to move out of, essentially, all the people who believe in God are going to leave the holy city. And if you look down just a couple verses, we're going to get to it in a little bit, but it says that essentially when all these things happen, after these two witnesses die, it says that city is now symbolically called Sodom and Egypt. And it's just interesting to me that, you know, you got to know that the city isn't what's important, but it's the people. It's the people that are there. So for 42 months, so essentially as these guys are going on, this particular thing takes place in the first half of the tribulation. If you look at Revelation 12:6, you'll see that it talks about what's going to happen after the nation of Israel flees. It says, and the women fled into the wilderness,
where she has a place prepared for her by God in which she will be nourished for 1260 days. So for half of the tribulation, they're going to be in worshiping God on them in Jerusalem. The next 3.5 years, basically, God is going to take them away so Satan can't get to them and put them in a place where he can nourish them for that same amount of time. And then we see in Revelation 13:5, and the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed and was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. And it opened his mouth and uttered blasphemies against God, blasphemies against his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. So the whole tribulation is wrapped up, although all the trumpets are going on, all these things are going on, but the first half of all that transpires with these witnesses out there preaching. These witnesses out there sharing the things that God has for them, out there doing the things that God's asking them to do. If we could sum up the first 3.5 years, I would say the first 3.5 years are bad, but we don't really uncork the great tribulation until the last 3.5 years, right? So for 3.5 years, these guys are out here preaching to the people, asking, God has given them a testimony to share, and these guys are out there witnessing to these people clothed in sackcloth, and they're basically trying to get people to turn to God for 3.5 years. I don't know how this always works, but it's kind of funny. I think of Noah. Noah's sitting on the boat, building the boat. It has never rained before, so they're building the boat, doing all this stuff. Everybody is coming and saying, man, that's crazy. That's stupid. That's weird. Until when? First raindrop hits, right? Then all of a sudden, people begin to get a little bit nervous about what's going on. I've never seen rain. But what happens once the door of the ark's closed? That's it. That time for you to come to Christ, the time when we were preaching, when we were doing all this stuff, there was a time where that ended and the judgment fell. And as we look at this first 3.5 years and we're looking at these two witnesses, as we kind of spread it out, granted there's horns going off and bowls and vials that are going to be poured out, but this first 3.5 years, God has set aside with two witnesses sharing, clothed in sackcloth, sharing and trying to teach the people. It's funny. I wonder how many times they get ridiculed, how many times things don't go particularly their way, but what are they doing? Every day. What do? Wake up, go out, witness to the people. Go out, witness to the people. Go out, witness to the people. And I can imagine Noah's probably the same way. How many times do you tell the same person the same thing and they don't listen that you finally go, that's it, I'm done with you. But here they are. How about God? How patient is God in all of this as he stands back and says, I've brought these guys right to your doorstep. All you got to do is listen. All you got to do is be a part. If you look at the two witnesses, it says they're, I gave authority to the two witnesses and they prophesied for 1260 days, which is the same 3.5 years, clothed in sackcloth. You know, one of the things, it's interesting. Most of the time, if you look at sackcloth and what's going on, usually it's in repentance of something that somebody has done, or putting on sackcloth and ashes is a concept that I'm humbling myself before the God who is going to fix this. I give my pains, my concerns, my problems to him. And for 3.5 years, that's how these guys witness to a backslidden nation, a backslidden world. You know, one of the things that kind of was convicting to me as I read this is that as I witness, as I share, a lot of times what you might not get out of it is repentance on my part. Or I get to tend to be a little harsh, or I tend to be a little judgmental, or I tend to be a little irritated with people, right? Because, man, you pour it out every day and these guys just aren't getting it. But how are we pouring out God's love? How are we ministering to the people? How are we telling people how to come? Is it like these witnesses? Are we empowered by God, doing God's work, and in a way, in a humble way?
It's something to think about. So as they are kind of going through, we're going to take a step back here. Verse 4, it says, "And they are my two olive trees and two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth." Now, if you look at that statement's also in several other places in the Bible. And the one that kind of really pops to me is Zerubbabel. Does everybody know the story of Zerubbabel? Yeah. Okay, so he's coming out of the Persian Empire. He's essentially been a captive for the last, 100 years. He hasn't been, but his family and generations. And he's coming back to Jerusalem, and God gives him a special gift. He gives him a special authority. So he becomes the governor of Jerusalem, and he has a guy with him that's a high priest. His name is Joshua. And these two guys build the temple. These two guys usher basically Israel back into a relationship of being able to worship God. Without the temple, they can't worship God. And so here he is, and it's crazy. As he describes them as two olive trees with pipes coming out of the olive trees going to lampstands. And these lampstands are sitting there, and the lamp's burning, right? But it's crazy when you think about that. It's like, what kind of fuel are those lamps burning? Olive oil, right? So check it out. If you're hooked to the tree, how good is that? If you're hooked to the tree, if God is the tree and he says, check it out, you're going to run on olive oil, you're going to run on the Spirit, you're going to run on the gifts and the power that I'm giving you, check it out, I'm going to plug you in right to the source. And that's how these guys operate, and that has to be the way we operate as Christians. Are we, when Zerubbabel goes there, man, everybody wants to kill him. Everybody. Nobody wants the temple to be put back up. There's guys wanting to fight all over town. He says they build the wall with one hand, with a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other. I mean, that's a rough day, right? I mean, you got to be pretty good with a sword if you can be doing masonry work and swinging that sword. But in Zechariah 4:14, it basically talks about, it says, "Woe to the mountain. When the trowel is in Zerubbabel's hand, it can make a mountain like a plain." Is there anything that we can't do with God's power? But are we connected to God's power like they are? These two witnesses, he says, these are the two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. When I am ministering and I am doing the things that I feel like God's calling to me, let me tell you, it's a real easy and a real quick way to know if I'm plugged into the olive tree. You want to know how I know? First thing is, when I'm plugged into the olive tree, I'm never mad. I never look at a sinner and go, "Man, you're ticking me off." You know, I try to equate it like this. What do babies do? They poop on themselves, right? You ever get mad at a baby for pooping on itself? No, pulls my hair, spits at me. I got a baby at home. I can't hardly sleep. He sleeps sideways, and every, you know, in the night, there's just like a kick going against the face, like all the time. I'm like, turn sideways. But do I spank him? Am I angry at my son because he doesn't understand? He doesn't get it? When I'm connected to Christ and I'm connected to God and I'm plugged into His power and I'm testifying with His strength. Guess what? I'm never mad at the things that sinners do. I'm never upset when they get angry or they dislike the things I say. I'm never upset when they don't respond the way I think they should. And that's how I know I'm connected. When a baby poops his pants, I just simply change it. Same thing with those of us supposed to be the way for us is those who know God and who have experienced Him and have spent time with Him. When a newcomer comes in and things aren't working out and they're gossiping or acting crazy or there's problems, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to love them through that. But here these guys are, standing on the front lines, and the thing that's, I think, most important about them is they're plugged into God's power. Let's see what happens and things they do. It says, "If anyone would harm them, fire pours out of their mouth and consumes their foes. If anyone would harm them, this is how he is doomed to be killed." Well, that'd be kind of neat, right? Keep it easy. You know, try to hurt me, don't like you.
you're gone. You know, that's some pretty jalapeno breath there. You know, just I wish it was always that easy. But it's crazy when we temper the truth, or when we have the concept of when we as believers speak the truth. Let me tell you, when we speak the truth to somebody in love, it's like heaping coals on their head, isn't it? The more, when I first came to Christ, the guy who brought me to Christ, his name's Bill, I talked about him all the time. But when he brought me to Christ, he kept loving me. He kept kind of working me through these things. And all the time when he told me the truth about the things I was doing, I was, hanging out with buddies, drinking too much, you know, kind of coming to church when I could. And, you know, it was kind of more of a thing. Like I went, I put $20 in. I thought, okay, me and God are good. But he kept bugging me and kept bugging me. And all the time when he spoke truth to me, it was like burning me up inside. It actually made me angry. I'm like, why are you telling me this? Is that the way that that we're doing it? But that same fire that he had in his words was tempered with love. When he spoke to me, it wasn't to put me down. It wasn't to make me feel less than. When he spoke, when he heaped those coals on my head, guess what he was doing? He was standing there with the pan saying, man, you can put them out. It's easy. Just give your life to God. It's easy to get them out. It's easy to change the places that you're going and the things that you're doing. And all you have to do is just stop it. These guys, the power of God is with them to protect them. And it says they can consume the foes that come with them, basically with the flames out of the mouth. I believe that they just speak a word and they die. The people that are trying to harm them. So we got two guys empowered by God, speaking the truth of God, seeing those things. And it's verse 6. It says, they have the power to shut up the sky that no rain may fall during the days of their prophecies. And they have power over the waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they desire. So you got these two guys. We're going to keep going back to the concept here. Two guys standing at the temple, professing God, empowered by God, with the power to shut up the rain. It's interesting. This is why I think the two guys are Elijah and Moses. This can be the arguing portion if anybody wants to chime in. Zerubbabel and Jonathan's one. Who's the guys who never died? Elijah and Enoch, yeah, those are guys out there. But I really think these two guys are Elijah and Moses, basically because of the powers that they kind of possess, the things that they have. But here these two guys are. They're out there. They're doing these things, empowered by God. What purpose? I mean, right? Shutting up the heavens, shutting up the rain, and turning the water into blood, that sounds kind of like a mean thing to do to people. Kind of sounds like a harsh reality. If we look at Elijah and his ministry, he did that very same thing. If you flip over to James chapter 5, verse 17 and 18, I'll read it to you real quick. It says, Elijah was a man with the nature like ours, and he prayed fervently that it might not rain. And for 3 years and 6 months, it did not rain on the earth. Then he prayed again, and the heavens gave rain, and the earth bore its fruit. So James is saying, man, he could stop the rain. He prayed, and for 3.5 years, interesting number, he was able to stop the rain. Does anybody remember when the rain came? Right? They have a little contest on Mount Hermon. And we got the priests of Baal and Elijah, right? And all of a sudden he says, okay, let's get down and dirty. Let's have this out. I like the way he does this. Let's have a little contest. Make it fair, you know. We'll go up on top of the mountain and we'll, make the altar and do all that. And then you call on your God, and we'll let you call on your God as long as you want to bring rain. Consume the altar. Got to bring rain. Got to make it happen. So, you know, fire from heaven as he, comes down. Says, okay. So they get up contest. They go up on top of Mount Hermon. They start all this stuff. And guess what happens? The prince, the prophets of Baal, what do they do? All day long, they're praying and nothing happens. I love him because he's a little bit sarcastic too. He goes, "Hey, maybe you guys should yell louder. You guys, he's not hearing you. You know, maybe your God's asleep. Maybe if he's asleep, maybe you should probably yell, and maybe he'll wake up, and then he'll, you know, he'll consume it. It'd be cool. Light the fire. It'll be all good, you know." And no. So they go all day. They start cutting themselves, and there's blood everywhere. Isn't it just like us to keep elevating the situation? And so it's Elijah's turn now. He finally, all day long, into the night, he finally cuts them off and says, "Okay, let me give this a shot and just throw it out there." He says, "Get some water." And he gets water, and he pours water all over the altar, and he says, "Okay, get another bucket of water. Get another pitcher." So he gets these 12 pitchers and pours it all over the water again. Then he digs a moat around it. I always like a little bit of a show off. if you're gonna do it, I think Elijah had some stage presence. He says, "I'm gonna do it big," and he gets it. And I think the reason why he's able to do that, because who's really gonna bring the fire? Does Elijah have to worry about bringing the fire? Yeah. The reason why he knows he can have that kind of stage presence is he knows who's bringing the fire. God's gonna do it. When it comes, it consumes everything, consumes the whole altar, and it's all said and done. And in the distance, as they're there, it says you could hear the rain coming. It's crazy. What was the point of him doing that? Why did he stop the rain? He stopped the rain to stop a people from believing in these false gods, to realize there's no power in that. Yeah, it's a harsh thing. Yeah, I mean, anybody been thirsty? Not have water for, you know, no rain, be in a drought for 3.5 years? It's harsh. But guess what? What was the point of it? The point was something very merciful. It was to let them know, man, you guys are worshiping the wrong God. You guys have made a mistake. How about Moses? You know, we see Moses, and if you flip over to Exodus chapter 7, verse 20, I'll read it for you real quick. It says, "Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. He lifted up his staff and struck the water in the Nile. And all of the water in the Nile turned into blood. And the fish in the Nile died. And the Nile stank. And so that the Egyptians could not drink the water from the Nile. And there was blood throughout all of the land in Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said." So here's Moses, and it says he's able to strike the water. That's exactly the same thing that these guys are able to do. It says he's able to turn the water to blood. So he turns all of the Nile to blood for what purpose? What's the purpose? Why did he do it? To soften a man's heart. The whole thing, the whole plagues, everything that happened in Egypt, certainly there was all kinds of people that were affected, but what was he trying to do? He was trying to get to one guy. He tried to soften his heart. He says, "Man, I'm doing it. The reason why God held back the rain was to straighten his people out. Why did he turn the water into blood? It was to soften men's heart." And if you look at what's going on in Revelation in chapter 11, what's the same reason why they're able to hit these people with all these plagues? What's the purpose? If our job, if we're going to compare ourselves to these two witnesses, what's our testimony? Am I doing this because I want to hurt people, or I want to be right, or I want to be rude, or any of these other things? Or am I doing it because my ultimate goal is to straighten them out mentally and to soften their hearts so that when they see God, they can make a choice for him? You know, if you look at the ways we minister, how do we tend to minister to our family members who don't know him? Or how do we, usually it's always in a fight, right? Carly will back me up on this. We got Aunt Pam, right? We like to talk religion. And we start going and we start talking about stuff. And I get so heated in the conversation that I forget that I'm supposed to witness to him in the power of God with a humbleness about me, with the word of truth, but also the things that I'm supposed to share and is supposed to be tempered with love, not to put them down, not to make them feel stupid, but to build them up, to really change that person's mind. You know, and it's funny, if you look at both of these things, you're going to find that if, you know, at this particular time in Revelation 11, there's something missing from the world if Elijah is stopping the rain, and Moses is turning the water to blood. There's an important element in life that's missing. That water, unfortunately, there's not a lot of things that will substitute, right? You can only drink so many Cokes. I don't know if that's true or not. Monster seems to get me Jackie by fine, but I'm not sure how he does it. But we should notice there's something missing in our lives. And as these guys were ministering to the people, I'm hoping the thing that came to them was there's something missing, there's something wrong. But we'll keep going. We're going to keep seeing and looking at what kind of what happened. So they had the power to shut the skies that no rain may fall during the days of their prophecies. And they had power over the water to turn it into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they desired. And when they had finished their testimony, the beast that rises from the bottomless pit will make war on them and conquer them and kill them. Crazy. So after they finish their testimony, what's the thing that the Bible says, how do we overcome this world? By the blood of the Lamb, by the word of our testimony, and what else? That we did not love our lives to the death. We did not love our lives more than laying them down for him. So here's these guys. They go all the way to the end, and their reward in all of it is death. And seems like a pretty bad reward. Seems like, man, they were doing the right things. They were, you know, empowered by God. They were, all of these things are coming together. But lo and behold, they die. It says that the beast from the bottomless pit has the power over them to conquer them. Let's check out and see what the world does. To conquer and kill them. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of that great city that symbolically is called Sodom and Egypt, where their Lord was crucified. So what city are we talking about again? Just to throw it out there. What happens when the people take over who are ungodly? That city spiritually becomes Sodom and Egypt. When it's controlled by God's people, it's the holy place, or the temple of God. It says, and they were basically there, Egypt, where the Lord was crucified, for 3.5 days from the people. Let me go back. For 3.5 days, some of the peoples and the tribes and languages and the nations will gaze at their dead bodies and refuse to let them be placed in tombs. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them and make merry and exchange presents, because these two prophets had been a torment to those who dwell on the earth. But after the 3.5 days, the breath of the life from God entered them, and they stood up on their feet, and great fear fell on those who saw them. And then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here." And they went up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies watched them. And at that hour, there was a great earthquake, and 1/10 of the city fell. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake, and the rest were terrified and gave glory to God in heaven. It's interesting. When we live this life, a lot of times we don't want to step out in our testimonies. We don't want to step out and say anything. Why? Because we don't want the world to dislike us, right? What did the Bible say about these guys? It says these guys were hated by the world because the things that they did brought torment to them. Just so you know, if you follow God and you believe in the things that he says and you want to do the right thing, it's going to be torment to the world. And as they, as these guys died, this kind of cracks me up. It's like another Christmas. These guys die. They've been bothering the people. They've been shutting up the rain. They've been causing all these problems. These guys die. What does the world do? Throws a party. Sweet. Can you imagine? Be like, oh, it's dead guy. It's dead witness day. Here's a present. It seems kind of weird that you would do that. I don't know. I just don't think that would make sense to me. But these guys hated these people so much that they will not allow them to be buried, and they throw a party. You know. Just so you guys know, I hope that we're hated by the world that much too. One of the things that we're going to be a witness for God is that if you're with God, you're not of the world. Bible says if they hated me, what are they going to do to you? right? If you're not for me, you're against me, right? This, it's really easy. If the world loves us, if everybody says there's all these great things, let me tell you, you're not doing the things that you're supposed to be doing for the lost. It's funny, as Christians, if we keep our mouths closed, guess what we get? They're good with us. As long as we keep our mouth closed and say homosexual marriage is okay and we don't really fight it, or aborting babies is fine, or whatever other, you know, controversial topic is, as long as us Christians keep our mouths closed about the things of God and the things that God's laid on our hearts and the things he says that aren't right, if we keep our mouth closed, the world is always going to be fine with us. You will go through this whole world and nobody will ever say anything bad about you. But let me tell you, you stand on a street corner and tell people it's not okay to abort babies, which seems like a no-brainer, right? Seems like a pretty easy concept. Don't kill your baby. Guess what? I've sat out there with Bill a couple times, and I must have been flipped off at least 20 times. California howdy, like everywhere. You know, it kind of cracks me up. I'm like, that is like the weirdest thing. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, Bill. I've seen people come by, and they're like frothing at the mouth, screaming, angry. You know, and I kind of crack up. I'm like, what does it bother you if I'm standing here trying to tell people that this isn't okay to kill babies? When did we get into, pretty soon I think we're going to live in a world where it won't be okay to say, it'll be a hate crime to say that I believe homosexuality is wrong, is a sin. Crazy. Pretty soon it won't be okay to do these things. And if we're going to be witnesses for God, are we willing to do that? Are you guys going to be willing to stand in the gap for the people who basically don't know and or are naive or deceived or whatever? Bill said, how many babies today? At least 8 babies today died. 8 babies. Now, granted, I get it. Everybody's got jobs and things to do, and we all have things that are going on. But I think we should be able to make a stand and say, that's not okay. I think we should be able to stand up for the people who have no voices, right? We just watched that movie, Voiceless. I think we ought to be able to stand up and do the things and actually exercise our faith the way God intended us to. If you look in the book of Ezekiel, God tells Ezekiel, man, I want you to be a watchman. Here's what a watchman does. A watchman, when you see an enemy coming at the gate, you run up on top of the tower and you say, there's an enemy coming. Real simple. And he says, check it out. You're going to be the watchman for the nation of Israel. But let me tell you what's going to happen. If you see the enemy coming and you don't run up and blow the horn and say, that's wrong, don't do this, their blood is going to be on your hands. And I remember reading that going, man, how much blood do I have on my hands? Because I just didn't open my mouth and say what God wanted me to say. But he also gave Ezekiel another promise. He says, if you run up on that hill and you blow the horn and you are the watchman and the people don't respond, your hands are clean. Your blood, I will not require their blood at your hands. And I want us to be that kind of people. I want us to be, I think that's important for us if we're going to be witnesses like these guys, that at the end of these guys' service, they could say just the same thing Paul did. I am innocent of the blood of all men. I did not shun to declare to them the whole gospel. I love them to the death. There was nothing I didn't do. And at the end of the day, if they don't love God and they're not a part of it, then it's because they don't want it. I did everything I could. Is that the kind of witnesses we are? This is the end of it, man. Verse 13. I love this. It's one of my favorite. Or actually back one. Verse 12, it says, then I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, come, saying to them, come up here. And they went up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies watched them. You know, one day God's going to set it all straight. No matter what I lose, no matter what happens in this world, no all the disappointments, if I'm focused and focused and determined to do the things that God's asked me to do, one day, even if they take my life away, God's going to give it back.
and he's going to give me a life that's better than all. But here's the reality. It says, and at that hour there was a great earthquake, and a tenth of the city fell, and 7,000 people were killed in an earthquake, and the rest were terrified, and they gave glory to the God of heaven. 7,000 people died who didn't know God. 7,000 people died, and it says they were terrified, and they gave glory to the God of heaven. Isn't it scary when dad has to spank you to get your attention? It's a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of an angry God, right? As these guys are resurrected and taken up to heaven, and the earth starts shaking and 7,000 people die, I'd be like, okay, I'm with you, God. Right? But why does it have to come to that? It shouldn't. The last of this verse, it says, verse 14, the second woe has passed. Behold, the third woe is soon to come. So as all this, kind of wrapping it up, cool section of scripture. I want you to definitely take home that, who the witnesses are, but I want you to see how they ministered, how they shared the gospel, by what power they did it. And I want us to be able to say that we can do the same thing. I want to be able to say, man, this is how I want to minister to people. And at the end, I hope I hope the breath of life comes back into me and I ascend into heaven just like they do, right? That's the plan. I'd actually prefer not to die, but hey, I'm kind of a realist. I hope Jesus comes back tomorrow, but I'm ready for the long haul. Why don't you join me in prayer? Let's go ahead and stand.